This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents To Shake the Sleeping Self, a 14,000-mile bike trip and one man's quest to live a life with no regrets. This is the author, Jedediah Jenkins. For my mom, who is as giving as spring, as fun as summer, as sacrificial as fall, and as strong as winter, as good to me as seasons are to the earth. For my dad, who taught me to drive down every dirt road, and who loves me the way sunlight loves us all. For Philip Crosby, who showed me how to let go of my house when the flood comes, and to build on higher ground. The Itch. The youth gets together his materials to build a bridge to the moon, or perchance a palace or temple on the earth. And at length, the middle-aged man concludes to build a woodshed with them. Henry David Thoreau. I've learned this for certain. If discontent is your disease, travel is medicine. It resensitizes. It opens you up to see outside the patterns you follow. Because new places require new learning. It forces your childlike self back into action. When you're a kid, everything is new. You don't know what's under each rock or up the creek, so you look. You notice because you need to. The world is new. This, I believe, is why time moves so slowly as a child. Why school days creep by and summer breaks stretch on. Your brain is paying attention to every second. It must, as it learns the patterns of living. Every second has value. But as you get older, and the patterns become more obvious, time speeds up. Especially once you find your groove in the working world. The layout of your days becomes predictable, a routine, and once your brain reliably knows what's next, it reclines and closes its eyes. Time pours through your hands like sand. This equation has a crummy side effect. While our child brains are absorbing the ways of the world, mislabeled patterns of survival get swept in as we grow. Bad examples, wrong thinking, mistaken assumptions. They get caught in the flow of time through adolescence and carried into adulthood. Buried beneath everything else. You watch your dad fly into a rage while driving, and your little brain logs it away. You overhear your mom talking about hell, and something rearranges in your head. A building block placed so deep and quickly covered. We show up as adults confused by our own thinking, and with time running out. But travel has a way of shaking the brain awake. When I'm in a new place, I don't know what's next, even if I've read all the guidebooks and followed the instructions of my friends. I can't know a smell until I've smelled it. I can't know the feeling of a New York street until I've walked it. I can't feel the hot exhaust of the bus by reading about it. I can't understand the humility of walking beneath those giant buildings. I can't smell the food stands and the cologne and the spilled coffee. Not until I go and know it in its wholeness. But once I do, that awakened brain I had as a kid, with wide eyes and hands touching everything, comes right back. This brain absorbs the new world with gusto. And on top of that, it observes itself. It watches the self and parses out old reasons and motives. The observation is wide. Healing is mixed in. This kind of attention is natural to a child. To an adult, it must be chosen. The trick is knowing when we are in fact adults and when attention is asleep. My name is Jedediah Jenkins. It's a sing-songy name, I know. Jedediah is Hebrew and it means loved by God or friend of God. My mom was dead set on giving me a biblical name. I mean, damn, she went straight for a wild one. I was named after Jedediah Smith, the fur trapper and explorer who discovered passages over the Rockies and died at the hands of the Comanche. As a kid, I loved it, and then hated it, and then loved it again. It sounded like a joke, like an Amish preacher. It was my first encounter with being different. Baby boomers would say, "Oh, like Jed Clampett, you must get that a lot." I'd say, "No, not really." People my age would say, "Ooh, like a Jedi. Are you a Jedi? Does everyone call you Jedi Master? I'm gonna call you that." They never did. On the whole, it's been nice, because people tend to remember it. I have a theory about this. When you have a weird name, one that's uncommon enough to stand out, but not a nightmare to pronounce, people remember you. And when they remember you, especially when you're young, it builds confidence. You feel special, worthy of being remembered. I don't know if this is true, clinically speaking, but I've always felt comfortable in a crowd, and I think it's at least in part because people remember my name, and that I am loved by God and God's friend, I guess. As I grew up, this smiling kid with a weird name was paying attention and making assumptions. I absorbed lessons and language and took them as truth. If you were a suburban kid like me, you probably grew up in a school system that wants you to go to college and choose a major and go straight into a job and a marriage and a mortgage. It gives you rungs of achievement, a degree, a wife, a house, kids, golf, whatever, and makes you think these things give life meaning. Collect them all and win. But the big fancy adults preach the opposite as well. They say fall in line, and then, in the same breath, think different, take risks. We are told follow your passion and stay hungry at every commencement and graduation speech. This mixture of school and risk is the holy cocktail of American ideals. And for those rare beacons of exceptional success, it turns their life stories into fables. But for ordinary folks, it is a difficult road to walk. Be sensible, but be wild. Be ordered, but be free. Be responsible, but take risks. I took this doublespeak to heart like any good kid born in the 80s. Do what you love and follow your passion became foundational virtues. But it's also slippery. Do what you love, but stay on the assembly line. There's no time to find what you love. You should be building your credit score. Take risks, but don't be foolish. Believe in yourself, but only if you've proven you should. Haven't you seen those idiots auditioning on American Idol, thinking they can sing? Don't be one of them. Don't embarrass yourself. Don't waste time at a job you hate, but magically manifest money to leave that job and chase a dream. Got it? Perfect. It didn't help that my parents were examples of this magic American potion. Both of them were raised poor. Both chased their dreams. Both had success. My parents taught me as a kid that I could be whatever I wanted to be. You can be a lawyer when you grow up, or a movie director, or a marine biologist. You can be anything you want. I remember their sweet encouragements, watching their pale, chubby son with a weird name swim with his t-shirt on. "You don't have to be good at sports, Jed, but it's good to try. We don't care what you do, so long as you give it your all. And don't feel stuck if you choose one thing. You can try it and choose something else later." This practical optimism gave me the worldview that life had many paths, all there in front of me always. The factor that I overlooked was the finiteness of time. This concept is invisible to a child. Kids may know logically that they will one day be old, but they can't feel it. It sounds like a rumor. The carefree timelessness of my youth was rattled in my 20s. A kind of panic set in. Time became visible. Each choice I made began to feel more and more final, as if every choice was the death of all the others. Millions of doors were locking behind me as I passed them in the hallway. I felt that age 30, adulthood, was coming like winter. Am I missing out? Am I making the right decisions? Am I becoming the person I want to be? It often dawns too late that we only have one life, only one path, and the choices we make become the storyline of our lives. This is the story of that panic and my response to it. I'd done everything right. I'd spent my 20s going to college and law school and getting a job and being a good boy. But when I turned 30, I quit my job and spent a year and a half bicycling from Oregon to Patagonia. It wasn't the job that chased me away. It was mortality. Everything before was exposition. Filling the hero of the story with background and tools. The life before had happened to me as childhood happens to everyone. The mark of adulthood is when we happen to life. 30 years old. I was now an adult, with or without my consent. And adults are responsible for their lives. I wasn't going to become someone I didn't choose to be. How I got to the bike really started after law school. My first lawyer job was working for in-house counsel at a cruise ship company. Not on a cruise ship, unfortunately, but in an office building in the suburbs. I needed money and I needed a job. Any job. The company was huge, thousands of employees. I spent that entire summer removing duplicates from an employee spreadsheet containing 13,000 names. I reworded memos and sat through hours of HR training about the proper way to shake someone's hand and the appropriate distance one should stand away from a coworker. I remember my supervisor called me into her office and said, "Jed, we need to talk. We have a policy of no more than 3 exclamation points total in any email, and you have 5 in your greeting of, 'Hello.' That's not acceptable." She wasn't joking. Now, in my more sober adult years, I can see how I don't need to be shouting in my emails with so many exclamation points. But in my 20s, this kind of reprimand terrified me. I seemed to be always in trouble, and I hated being in trouble. I'll die if I work here, if they don't fire me first. In my moment of despair, my old friend Jason reached out and offered me a job. He had made a documentary about war in northern Uganda, and it had become a big deal. "Jed, we're turning our documentary into a nonprofit. It's becoming a movement. We're growing like crazy. Thousands of high school and college kids are starting clubs based on the doc. Come work for us. We need an attorney. We don't know what we're doing. Imagine working with your best friends and changing the world. You'll make like no money, but it'll be fun and important." In that moment, I pictured myself working in the cruise company's office for decades, bowing to the shareholders, hating work, and therefore buying things, a house and a nice car, and having kids and sending them to private school, raising them to chase their dreams, and lying with my life. That frightened me. I told my friend yes. I'd figure out how to make money later. For now, I'd be poor and happy. I worked at the nonprofit for 5 years and enjoyed it. We did national tours, setting up clubs in high schools, building fundraiser campaigns for students each semester. So even though I was out of school, I still felt time pass in semesters. As 30 approached and youth was passing into adulthood, the terrible reality of time hit me like a wet rag. I looked back on my 20s and realized that every time there was a crossroads, I took the first and safest path. I did just what was expected of me, or what I needed to do to escape pain or confusion. I was reactive. I didn't feel like an autonomous soul. I felt like a pinball. Let me add another layer to my thinking at that time. My faith. I loved God and Jesus and believed I was a friend of God. He had a plan for my life. A plan to make me prosper. A legacy to live in testament to Him. I was raised this way. It added a glaze over every choice. It was God's plan for my life. And with the Creator of the universe pulling the strings, how could any of it be mundane? So my fear of 30, my anxiety over missing my calling, carried with it a dull guilt. Was I trusting God enough? Were my ambitions self-serving? Was I doing enough in the service of the kingdom? Was I laying my life on the altar of his will? I didn't know, but I knew I wanted to do right, to live right, to be good. This confluence of motivations and choices had taken me through a good education and into a bad job and then a good job, and I'd learned a lot and had fun and collected some skills, but I couldn't shake the thought it wasn't really mine. It was happening to me. I was making steps toward myself, just trying things out, as my parents had taught me. Nothing has to last forever, Jed. Try it and then try something else. Sure, that works for a while, but sooner or later, that's not cute anymore. You can't keep jumping ship. Looking back now, my discomfort with career and time and choices was the smoke of a deeper fire. An important part of me was covered and squirming. It had something to do with my faith, in doubts and questions. There were deep parts of me that were wounded by Christianity. There were also deep parts of me that loved Jesus and gave him credit for everything good in my life. This created a tension. And because I was taught that salvation rested on belief, on saying the right words and believing the right creeds, doubt was akin to cancer. Treat it, or it will kill you. I couldn't have said it then, but now I know. My soul was afraid of dying. Not simply from loss of salvation, but from loss of self. If I really was loved by God, a friend of God, I wanted true friendship. Friends do not walk blindly, one behind the other. They walk shoulder to shoulder. I wanted clarity from my friend, to hear answers to my questions. When you don't know what to do, you travel. You go out and see. You have to rattle the bed, shake yourself out. I wanted to start my 30s like I started life, wide awake. I didn't have kids, I didn't have a mortgage. I felt like this was my last chance to crawl into the driver's seat of my life. Eventually, an idea took shape. It was 2010, I was 27 years old. I was talking with a coworker who'd been hired to run our nonprofit work in Uganda. I had just met him and I was asking him simple questions, really just a small talk of getting to know a new hire. His name was Andrew. He was tall and rugged. His skin was brown from loads of sun. His crow's feet were deep from squinting. I asked him what he was doing before he came on board. "I came straight to Uganda from Patagonia," he said. "I rode my bicycle to Argentina from New Jersey." "What? A bicycle? Across all those countries? My God, what a man." My face got hot and my eyes got big and my mind filled with questions. Like the clarity of love at first sight when you spot someone across the room and know that they are yours. This idea struck me like Cupid's arrow. Could I do that? What an adventure. Am I man enough? Could I finish? How long does that take? I can ride a bike, but haven't in ages. I can camp. I can eat almost anything. Does he think I can do it? He started showing me photos and my insecurities fizzed in my mind. No, I cannot do this. As a kid, I tried to play soccer and was terrible. I tried to run cross country and I was slow. I was soft and feminine. I wanted to be a tough kid. It was a tender bruise on my identity. So, I became the funny kid. "Hey Jed, we're gonna play touch football after school if you're interested," they'd say. "Ha, yeah right. I don't sweat unless I'm running from the cops." They'd laugh and I felt safe for a moment. My dad was a farmer with calloused hands. Back sweat stained his denim shirts from riding the tractor. My mom was a fearless country girl from Missouri. My best friends in high school were varsity baseball and football players. I'd always been the soft one, reading a comic book or playing in the woods. I wanted to impress them, though if you'd asked me then, I wouldn't have known that. It was buried too deep for me to see. As Andrew scrolled through incredible photos of Mexico and Peru on his phone, he explained his route. It took about a year and a half, I did it alone, met people along the way. I'd been teaching high school in New Jersey and felt that the students needed an example. They needed to see what the world had to offer. So I wrote blog posts for them, and I would Skype in to tell them stories from the road. It changed my life. I must have been looking at him like a spooked owl, mouth agape. "Jed, I don't tell this to many people," he said, "but you should do the bike trip. You would love it." I didn't know this man. I'd just met him, and he said this to me. I could do that? This true adventurer thought I could handle it. A man that had cycled 10,000 miles believed I had what it took to do the same. He looked at me and saw an athlete. That felt better than I'd like to admit. I looked Andrew in the face and said, "I'm gonna do it." I paused, staring over his shoulder at nothing. "I swear I am." It felt like prophecy. I would hit the road and find the world. I didn't know what I was to become, but I knew I had to take steps in some direction. I was speaking to myself as much as I was speaking to him. I was speaking to the universe. "I'm gonna go on a bike trip like yours when I turn 30. "How old are you now?" he asked. 27. "Okay," Andrew said proudly. "You need to tell friends and family about it. That'll help the trip be a part of your daily consciousness from here on out. You'll talk about it, and people will expect you to do it. And their social pressure will help prevent you from chickening out and making excuses." "Okay," I said, wide-eyed, realizing the bigness of it. But I had to do it. It felt correct. It felt like a key I'd been looking for. I needed movement. I knew it would answer questions and change me. I didn't know that this trip would free me from shackles I couldn't see. I didn't know it would pry my fingers from parts of myself that had to go. I was holding tight to the narratives of my youth like treasure, but with hands full, I couldn't receive anything new, and I couldn't see that I was clutching both treasure and poison. Part 1, West Coast, 13,990 miles to go. Chapter 1, The Plan. In early 2011, I told my friends and coworkers. I posted a map of South America on my Instagram. "When I turn 30, I'm cycling to Patagonia." Some people cheered me on. "Fuck yeah, go get 'em." Other people laughed. "Isn't it a little early to be telling us your plans 3 years from now?" "No," I said. "Gotta speak it into existence." Other people shamed me. "Don't be so self-congratulatory. You haven't even done anything yet. Hit us up when you've actually done something." I soon told my parents. They're divorced, so it was two separate calls. Always my mom first. They were thrilled initially. "Following in our footsteps, I see," my mom said. I hadn't even considered that fact. My parents walked across America in the 70s. My dad was in his mid-20s, my mom in her late-20s and early-30s. It took 5 years, and they wrote about it for National Geographic. They were even on the cover. August 1979, if you want to track it down. They were in search of America and themselves in the middle of the cloud Vietnam cast over this country. They went on their spirit quest, and now I was going on mine. Who was I to think I had come to this idea completely on my own? As my mom began cautioning me to the dangers of cycling across Mexico, my mind was off somewhere else, thinking about destiny and the pre-ordering of things. How so often we become our parents, whether we like it or not. I had walked right into mom and dad's shadow without noticing. Let me digress about them for a minute. They became famous from their walk. They wrote best-selling books about it. They traveled the country speaking and doing interviews. They were next to household names. They also became famously Christian. My dad's testimony was raw and dramatic, a New England kid from public housing who went to Woodstock and did drugs and never found a rule he couldn't break. He found Jesus on the walk at a charismatic revival meeting in Mobile, Alabama. He found my mom in a seminary outside of New Orleans, an angel-faced girl from the Ozarks who loved the Lord and knew scripture better than anyone. Her voice and soft skin gave her the appearance of someone who'd jump at the sight of a mouse. But she was fearless. She'd grab a snake right out of the grass. When my dad met her, he turned on all the charm he could muster and seduced her out of seminary. "Marry me and let's walk to Oregon." Can you imagine? She said yes. I exist because of it. After the walk and publication of the National Geographic story and the subsequent best-selling book, they traveled and enjoyed their fame and worked on new books together. Somehow, they managed to represent both the counterculture of 1970s youth and the wholesome church-going middle. They were curious about America. They loved Jesus, but didn't fear the differences of human beings. For a moment in the sun, they were America's dusty, sun-kissed sweethearts. They had three kids, I was the middle baby, and bought a farm in Tennessee. Then, at the height of it all, their marriage fell apart. The perfect couple crashed. Dad was gone a lot. He kept traveling, writing, speaking, and apparently doing other things. My mom was home with the kids. Maybe my dad's charisma got the best of him. I remember him talking to a Waffle House waitress with no teeth for an hour. He's the type of man who sees a dead-end gravel road and turns down it just to know how far it goes. Maybe his best quality was his Achilles heel. I was a little kid at the time. I don't know what really happened. She told him to quit cheating, and she later kicked him out. Their empire fell. And nothing falls quite like a Christian celebrity. But through all the mess of divorce and parenting and maintaining public personas, my parents were excellent to us kids. Weekdays with Mom and weekends with Dad. Mom making art projects at night with us. Dad taking us out on the tractor to feed the cows. Whatever storms were happening between them, in their careers and finances, I had no idea. And in spite of it all, they remained explorers to the core. They had walked America's back roads and mountains and deserts, and they would raise their kids to love them the same, even if they had to do it separately. We didn't have much money growing up. Writing a couple bestsellers will keep you afloat for a while, but if you can't keep it up, the money runs dry. Add in three kids and an expensive divorce, and it gets hard. But my parents knew how to live on a little. Instead of flying to islands or going on ski trips, we went camping. We took long road trips to see the Grand Canyon, the Badlands, the Wild West. My mom would plug in the camper and I'd disappear to the creek. Or down a canyon, or come back hours later with a turtle or a bone. Mom and Dad never pressured us to become adventurers. And they mentioned the walk only in passing. But they taught me to look around, to explore, and that it didn't cost a whole lot of money to do it. They always told us that we could do whatever we wanted, be whatever we wanted. They had the American dream in the twinkle of their eyes. Both had been rewarded, even if only for a moment, with the fame that comes from taking a chance, risking it all for an idea that awakens the soul. The point of bringing up their parenting style is this. Somehow, my parents had tricked me. They had made me respect them and want to emulate them, all without me realizing it. And comically, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to go on a great adventure in a way that felt completely original to me and spontaneous, like I was the first person to ever think of such a thing. I didn't do much prep for those next 3 years. I continued to work at the charity and build campaigns and work on documentaries. But the coloring of those years was different. I knew I'd be leaving as soon as I turned 30. I knew I had a giant adventure on the horizon. This knowledge changed the way I perceived time. My job felt more important. I took on more responsibility and worked harder because I only had so much time to get things done. I stopped feeling trapped. I had an escape stomping my way. You might think I would have ridden my bicycle and trained, but nope, I didn't do shit. I guess I was confident that I could ride a bike, I didn't even own one, and that I'd learn as I went. Or maybe training would have made it too real, too scary. Thank God I told people about my trip, I thought. If I hadn't, it would be so easy to not do it. I would have changed my mind 100 times. The inconvenience of uprooting my life, of stepping away from all that I had built, was enormous. But the questions had never ceased. When do you leave? You still doing that crazy trip? I'm so jealous. Have you been training? Then, quite suddenly, it was 2013, and I was 30 years old, and it was time to leave. Whoa, I had looked down, and it was here. I Googled and read cycling blogs. Some had incredibly detailed maps and warnings and packing guides that measured out the weight of this and the weight of that. Some bloggers were so ill-prepared, their journals read like Shakespearean tragedies. I thought of my inspiration, Andrew, the one who had done the trip before. I had to talk to him. I emailed him. He was off training new employees in Uganda. I needed a pep talk. I was overwhelmed. "Don't plan too much," he wrote. "You can't assume that a map tells the truth in Central and South America. Just know that you need to make it 40 to 60 miles south each travel day. Trust the locals. Ask the people you meet what's the best way to go, the most beautiful. Let the place tell you where it wants you to go. The worst thing you can do is assume you know now what you'll know then, and don't let anyone else dictate your trip for you. If you want to take a bus sometimes, take a bus. If you need to hitchhike, hitchhike. It's your trip. Not anyone else's. If you try to be too fanatical about it, you'll spend more time stressing out and less time seeing a place for what it is. I liked the sound of that. I picked a date 5 months out. I'd start on August 28th in Oregon. I would travel south, mostly along the Pacific coast, cross the Darien Gap in Panama, and follow the Andes from Colombia all the way to Patagonia, the very bottom of the inhabited planet. The whole thing would take 16 months. The timing was important. I needed to follow the dry season. If you hit Central and South America during the rainy season, you're soaked for months. If you hit them in dry season, you'll have only sunshine. And if my pace was correct, I would also hit Patagonia in its spring summer, which would be November and December of 2014. I had to time it right, because Amazon rainy seasons and Patagonian winters would ruin me and possibly send me home. 2 months before launch day, I walked into REI and found the bike guy. The people who work at gear stores usually frighten me. So many times I had tried to buy a sleeping bag or running shoes or a tent, and the guy made me feel like an idiot. They can get a tired tone in their voice, exhausted from explaining to so many basic bitches how the forest works. If I had started this trip at 20 years old, I would have trembled as I asked him what kind of bike I should use for a 16-month trip through Latin America. But 30 is different. By 30, I had learned a valuable lesson. You are not an idiot. It's okay if you don't know everything. Don't pretend. Ask all the questions you want. It's fine if you're not prepared for the zombie apocalypse at all times. So I walked in, told the young guy I needed a bicycle that could get me to Chile. He cocked his head like a dog and asked me if I had been training. When I said no, a confident nope, he called for some old guy in the back. Richard's ridden his bike across the U.S. 3 times, the young guy said. Richard's legs were bowed and his hair was white and thick. His hands were black with grease. He looked me up and down and must have decided it wasn't worth his time to discourage me. You should go with a surly long-haul trucker, he said. He motioned to a relatively simple-looking bike hanging on the wall. It looked thick and heavy. It had no fanciness about it. It didn't look fast or sleek. It was just a dark green bicycle. If you're headed to South America, you don't want a fancy carbon bike. That thing breaks and you'll be hitchhiking the rest of your trip. You want steel. Any mechanic can weld steel if you get hit by a car or a bus. This Surly is tough as hell. It's heavy but sturdy. That's the one you want. He showed me the multi-tool I should get, which is basically a Swiss Army knife for bikes, and he also said I needed panniers. What are panniers? I said. He looked at me for a silent beat, certainly thinking, this boy is going to die. They are saddlebags that you hang from the side of your bike, he said. I did exactly as Richard said and bought it all. Instead of a tent, I bought a hammock. I wanted to be off the ground, away from critters. The wise man continued, if you're going to sleep in a hammock, you'll need a reflector pad underneath you to hold in your body heat, or else you'll freeze. But don't buy one here, it's $40. Go to Walmart and buy one of those dashboard sun reflectors for $5. It's the exact same thing. God bless this curmudgeon. Bingo. The emails from my mom never stopped, and the calls. She called me at the office a few months before my last day. Jed, she said, which in her southern accent sounds more like Jed. I just don't know about you going through Mexico. It's too dangerous. I could hear grunting through the phone as she moved her shih tzu off the bed. Okay, let's get you some food, she mumbled, distracting herself with the dog to minimize the electricity of confrontation. Mom, I've been to Mexico many times. Everyone I speak to who's been there says it's misunderstood and beautiful. They say Fox News makes people scared and think it's only cartels and freeloaders wanting to get here. Well, how could Mexico be so great if they're all trying to come here? I don't think that's true. They're not all trying to get here. I'm just worried about you. I don't want you cycling alone. I know you're going to say that I walked across America and my parents were worried about me, but it's different. America is different than Mexico. Mom, you know I have to go on this trip. I've been telling people for 3 years now. I have to. You know that feeling. I feel called to it. Yes, I know, I know. To whom much is given, much is required. I'll plead the blood of Jesus over you every day. If anything happened to you, Mom, I'll be fine. And it's not the 70s. I'll have a phone and I can text you and get Wi-Fi and call you all the time. When you and Dad did the walk, what did you do? We found payphones and called our parents once a week, she said. I know that me being paranoid is ironic because I did this to Mimi, and I didn't have a phone then. But that's what happens when you become a mother. You become the things that drove you crazy as a kid. It's the way God made it, to humble us, I think. You don't need to worry. Well, you can't go alone. I forbid it. Do you hear me, Jedediah? I forbid it. I have no rebellion in me. If my mom forbade me from going, I'd be in a bad spot. I never did drugs, never even tried them. That's what the bad kids did, and that wasn't me. Alcohol seemed trashy, drugs seemed debased. To this day, it's hard for me to break a rule, especially if I've been told explicitly. This scenario has played out in my life 1,000 times. A guard will say, "Sir, you can't be in here. I'm gonna need you to leave." My friends will say, "He's not looking, let's go." And I say, "But he said we can't," and I slump away. I wanted to be a good boy, so I agreed to invite someone else along. Well, to be honest, before I had the chance, he invited himself. His name was Weston. He was visiting San Diego from New York 3 months before I was set to leave, and we'd met a handful of times. I was sitting in my office getting through emails when he walked in. He bounced from desk to desk saying hi to people, and I could hear his voice and the exclamations of people who knew him and were overjoyed to see him. It's that guy Weston, I thought. What's he doing in California? He came into my office and grabbed me by the shoulder. I heard you're going on a year-long bike trip. I need an adventure. I'm restless. And I want to be a character in a book, he said. You can write whatever you want. I have nothing to hide. There was something endearing about Weston's narcissism. Broke and drinking expensive beer. Handy, clever, and tireless. Always on fire for a new idea, a new girl, a new food. He had held tons of jobs, started businesses, started newer ones in the middle of starting new ones. You never really knew where he lived or where he was. He was tall, muscular, tattooed. Handsome in a way, severe in another. Women loved him. He loved that women loved him. Why did he want the bike trip? I think he had burned that entrepreneur candle so hard, riding on the fumes of people believing in him, that he got singed. A long ride would be a reset. I thought there was a good chance he might get me in trouble or drive me mad, but maybe I craved that. So I said yes and told Weston the plan. We would start the trip at Jesse M. Honeyman State Park, halfway down the Oregon coast. The same beach where my parents finished their walk across America. I wanted to walk my bicycle into the water where they had finished. I would pick up the baton. A package came in the mail to my house. It was from my mom. I opened it up, and it was a little pocket Bible, leather-bound, beaten up, worn, with rounded edges. I opened it up and found red and blue underlining everywhere, notes in the margins. My mom's handwriting, and some of my dad's, too. I recognized each handwriting style. Inside the flap was a note. Jed, this was the Bible I carried in my pocket during the whole walk across America. I read it every night. When I was scared, God's word was with me. He is always with you. I love you. He loves you. It was holy to touch. A tangible anchor to my mom in her late 20s, my dad in his mid-20s, the God of the universe with them. Wow. I kept it in my pocket from that day forward. As the day approached, the trip became the only topic of conversation at the office. My trick of telling everyone had worked a little too well. Everyone asked me about it. Are you ready? Did you learn Spanish? Have you been training? Nope. Nope, nope. I had meant to learn Spanish. I even bought Rosetta Stone, which is like $600. And I'd done it for a grand total of a week. Damn it, so typical. But here it was. The trip was around the corner. The spring and summer of 2013 disappeared, and August popped up like a jack-in-the-box. By the time Weston and I flew to Portland to start the damn thing, I was sick and tired of talking about the trip and not being on it. I wasn't nervous. I was just ready to get everyone off my back. I was so afraid of being labeled a talker and not a doer. I boxed up my bike and some clothes and left the rest to buy in Portland. Weston had virtually nothing, a small bag. I thought I was unprepared. Weston was so self-confident, his lack of preparation came off like a deeply considered preparation in itself. I don't want to have too many things figured out, he said the night before we flew out. I'll buy a bike on Craigslist when I get there for a couple $100. Are you sure? What if there aren't any? There will be. There's bikes everywhere. And if not, it'll work out. Gotta trust the universe. If one door closes, you know? Well, yeah, that's cool, but we do need to leave on the 28th. Don't worry, brother. I got this. I like that you worry. I like that you have a bike and extra gear and stuff. I got this. He was so confident, it made me wonder if I was the one doing this the wrong way. We woke at 6 a.m. and drove to the San Diego airport to catch a flight for Portland. I checked my bike and watched it disappear on the conveyor belt. I paid $50 because it was overweight. Weston just walked on. Chapter 2. It Begins. 13,990 miles to go. At my friend's house in Portland the night before we left, I laid out everything I was packing. I wanted to put eyes on it and wrap my head around my life support system of things. The bike sat shiny and unblemished against the fireplace mantel. It had no memories. The rear rack was black and sturdy looking. Next to my bike were the two panniers, made of black plastic with reflectors painted on both sides. One bag would be for my bike and camping stuff, the other for my clothes. I had 5 t-shirts, a pair of bike shorts, normal shorts, a pair of swim trunks, jeans, 7 pairs of underwear, a sweater, a denim shirt, and a women's rain jacket purchased last minute from a Goodwill in Portland. I knew that I wouldn't keep the clothes folded for the whole trip, so I just shoved them into the left pannier, halfway attempting to keep the layers for warmth at the top for access. The right pannier got everything else. A tire pump, extra tubes, my hammock, a little bag of medicine and band-aids from my mom, my books, my journal, my multi-tool for fixing and adjusting bike stuff, and my food. Almonds, apples, oranges, cans of tuna, crackers. The panniers hung from the sides of the rack, leaving the top of it open. That was where my backpack and sleeping bag went. Also a cheap, giant green tarp. Weston didn't have money, which he said was intentional. He was experimenting with a form of fundamentalist anti-capitalism. He gave hourly dissertations challenging society, the government, the wealthy, the systems of organized humanity. Whenever he was forced to use money, it seemed like a small defeat. He had a prophet's disposition, always feeling watched and therefore an example to the masses. He differed greatly in one respect from most evangelists, though. He was neither dogmatic nor forceful. He believed nothing was more powerful than example. That night while I was packing, Weston got on Craigslist, just like he'd said he would. He found a road bike for $300. It was pink and looked to be at least 30-40 years old. He had panniers that a friend had made by hand, each one a little larger than a lunchbox, which is tiny. My panniers were the size of couch pillows. He had no sleeping bag either, just a blanket he grabbed from a pile at Goodwill. It wasn't even a quilt or a full-size blanket, but a small red throw that would only cover your legs. I think it was intended for decoration. As I fell asleep, I thought of all the things I was leaving behind. My comforts, my expensive coffee and craft beer and back porch hangs with my friends, my routine and my life. I knew it wasn't forever, but it felt like it. What if my friends went on without me? What if my absence revealed that I was never really necessary? What if no one notices I'm gone? I said a prayer to myself. God, keep me safe. Keep Weston safe. Teach me what you want to teach me. Prove my mom wrong. Help me meet the people I'm supposed to meet. Don't let me embarrass myself. Give me the strength to do this whole thing. I hope I'm not making a mistake, I thought. Ugh, am I? Is this some pride thing, to prove something to people? What if I can't even make it to LA? I had, in normal fashion, trailed off from talking to God to simply thinking, talking to myself. I always scolded myself for doing this, for doing it wrong, for not actually talking to God. Amen. The next day, August 28th, was launch day. It was time to go. But we took forever to get ready. We went through each piece of gear, speaking out loud its necessity. 10-gallon water bag for the desert. Headlamp for camping. We went to the supermarket that morning and shopped for too long. We bought enough food for a bomb shelter, even though we'd be traveling in the United States for the next 1,000 miles and never so remote as to not have a restaurant a few miles away. Our friends Colin and Stella drove us out. The car ride was charged with energy, with the feeling that we were all part of something important. Maybe it was just me feeling this. I was noticing the curves of the road, the laughter, the Rascal Flats and Fleet Foxes we blasted on the radio, taking note to remember this drive and this moment. It felt like a slow-motion music video. I knew that the first 1,000 miles would be a training ground. I had never been the kind of person who knows how to do things. I had no idea how to work on a bike, how to change a popped tire, fix a slip chain, raise or lower a seat. But I figured the first leg of the trip would give me the chance to learn what I really needed, how to camp in the wild, how to hide, what food I needed, all of it, before I got to Mexico. We pulled our bicycles out of the car and hauled them over the dunes that separated the parking lot from the water. I recognized the beach from the grainy photos in National Geographic of my parents crying and kissing, walking into this very water after their 5 years spent crossing the country. A wave of sadness hit me, thinking about 1979 and the joy they felt at seeing this water. Knowing that in those photos, my mom was already pregnant with my sister. That they had no idea what the future held for them. Deeply in love and freshly accomplishing the impossible. And God rubbing his hands together, laughing. The start of a big journey makes every detail feel monumental. At least it does for me. The color of the sand on the beach and off-white. The grass on the dunes, sharp and coarse. The breeze from the ocean, cold and smelling like dead fish. And underlying it all, my insecurities. I don't know how to do anything bike-related. I don't even know if my body can do this. What if I have knee problems? What if I have back problems from being hunched over all day and can't finish? Wait, I never even thought of this stuff. What else haven't I thought of? I carried my bike into the waves at Honeyman State Park Beach in Florence, Oregon. Weston and I dipped our tires into the shallow surf, had Colin and Stella take a few pictures of us standing with the bikes like proud cowboys, and then carried them back over the dunes to the asphalt road. "I guess this is it," I said. "It's as easy as clipping in and hitting the road." My panniers were heavy and full. My bike didn't have a kickstand, which I found perplexing as I clumsily tried to clip the panniers onto the bike rack. Weston showed me a trick of spinning the bike pedal backward and then using it as a kickstand on the curb. This allowed me to attach my panniers and then load my sleeping bag and backpack in between them, creating a massive camel hump of stuff on the back of the bike. By the time I got it all tied on, it looked sloppy, wobbly, like a homeless shanty on two wheels. I took my helmet and sat it on my head. It was big, bulky, and painted in bright, idiotic colors, red and white and yellow. It's hard to find a cool bike helmet. When I snapped it on and looked at myself in the reflection of Stella's car, I gasped. I looked like a 10-year-old kid with a beard. I looked like a nerd. I didn't look like some rugged adventurer. I looked like a kid on a leash. Weston didn't have a helmet, didn't even buy one. When I tried to maneuver my bike around to mount it, I was shocked at the weight. It fell over. It was so heavy I could barely lift it. Shit. Colin and Stella stood back, arms crossed, laughing as they watched us. Colin was an avid cyclist. Stella wasn't, but reveled in our clumsiness. "When you clip in, you will fall several times," Colin said, "so just expect it. That way it won't hurt your pride when it happens. Everyone falls." I finally got the bike up and threw my leg over the saddle. Colin's eyes widened. "Jed, your seat is way too low. Is that how you ride? When you're seated, you should have to stick your legs straight out to touch the ground, no bend. Pedaling down should almost completely extend your leg." "Really? Oops," I said. "I am so screwed." No, you'll get it. It's fine. Let me fix your seat and then practice around this parking lot. You haven't practiced with weight yet? No. Colin looked at Weston. Have you? He said. No, but I was a bike messenger in New York City. I'm all good. Colin raised my bike seat and handled my heavy bike without effort. I was embarrassed, reminded of how bad I am at sports. He kindly and patiently gave it back to me. Try this. I got on and tried to clip my ugly bike shoes into the pedals. It didn't make sense. Colin laughed. You have to twist your foot in and twist your foot out. Straight down won't work. Wiggle your foot on it till they snap into place. I did, and they snapped in. My feet were now attached to the bike. I felt the bike begin to tip over and instinctively pulled my foot to brace my fall. But my foot was attached to the goddamn bike. I couldn't. I fell over sideways and hit the pavement like something out of a cartoon. What the hell? How am I supposed to do this? I said, wiggling and still attached to the bike. I'm going to tear my ACL and MCL and AT&T, I shouted. It'll become second nature, Colin said, laughing. Just get some momentum and practice. I clicked my shoes in and out over and over until I understood how it worked. Then I rode around in a figure eight cautiously. At 4 p.m., way later in the day than we had hoped, we hugged our friends, said goodbye, and rode away from the beach, with me looking ridiculous in my helmet. My body was an adrenaline whirlpool. Almost immediately, Weston was riding without hands, sitting straight up with his perfect posture, stripping his shirt off, and looking free. That first day, we rode toward Reedsport, along the coast, and past tall pine trees and the occasional house. The day was sunny and beautiful and full of nervous laughter. Weston rode shirtless with no hands most of the afternoon, which would soon become his general uniform and style. His old cheap bike rattled in its imperfections, but it seemed to work. My new bike was heavy and strong. We were loving it, braiding back and forth as we rode, flowing like happy salmon up a river. Taking up the road, getting honked at, cussing at nothing and cracking up. We found it was fun to swear at the perfect sky and trees, just shouting curses at them. I had posted on my Instagram for launch day, 4 years coming, it's coming tomorrow. Friends and family and people I didn't know commented. So excited to follow along. Ah, I feel like I'm doing this with you, I have so much anxiety. I want to pick up and quit my job and join you. How did these new people find me? I didn't want to do the normal travel blog thing. I'd never loved those blogs, as they were long-winded and the formatting was ugly. Writing essays about my trip and assuming anyone would care seemed self-indulgent. I thought, if everyone is already checking Instagram, I'll just give them little updates and photos as I go. That seems less presumptuous and easier. I had never done a long ride. Neither had Weston. Latin America loomed ahead of us. The southern hemisphere. So far away. Thoughts crept in while I rode. I speak almost no Spanish. Weston is the same. What's the word for bathroom again? But when the surge of anxiety would swell up, my optimism would kick in, like it was triggered by a racing heart, and I would be flooded with certainty that it would all work out. I wonder if the old explorers and bold nomads of the past had this chemical nature to their brain, a foolish hope that the other side of the mountain wouldn't kill them. We cycled down the Oregon coast, tall evergreen trees pushed into the clouds like sticks into a pillow. We watched the coastal sand changing from beige to black, the rocks rising sharply out of the ocean like an invading army. Nothing here was smooth, not even the waves. They erupted in jagged rollers of green and blue, lifting knots of seaweed and sticks to smash against the rocks. I tried listening to music that first day, but it felt wrong and forced. Even with all my natural positivity, I was feeling heavy, dragging behind my bike all the billion unknowns. When will my tire pop? When will Weston's bike fall apart? Where will we sleep tonight? And the next night? And the next? My phone was clipped to a holster at the front of my bike, between my handlebars, and right in my line of sight.